AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for the second hour of the Matt McNeil Show on this Tuesday afternoon. Have no fear, though. Matt will return to the airwaves soon, so you might be getting some fill-in hosts throughout the week, including myself and several other people. Coming up on the show today, at least during the second hour, have a couple of interviews I'll be playing back for you. Of course, if you're a regular listener of the Matt McNeil Show, you know that every Tuesday I do an interview with Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer, and we did record an interview earlier today as we're talking about the latest happenings over at the state legislature and other Minnesota political news, including a new Republican candidate for governor. We'll be playing back that interview with Patrick Coulican coming up in the next segment. Also ahead on the show today, Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is going to join us as we're going to be talking about Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. Now, what do Social Security and Medicare have to do with infrastructure? Well, on the surface, probably not a whole lot. But if you dig a little bit deeper into what's in the Democrats' bill for infrastructure, there are a lot of benefits towards seniors and disabled people, especially when it comes to affordable housing. So we'll be chatting about that much more in depth coming up in the second half of the hour. It's something that's easy to miss when it comes to that infrastructure bill, because you might sit there and think, well, that's just roads and bridges. But there are a lot of other things that I think fit that definition of infrastructure, including several of these provisions that are really going to help people out that are seniors or disabled and others. So that'll be Max Richman, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, coming up in the second half hour of the show. But before we get to both of those interviews, let's do a quick rundown of what's been in the news locally in Minnesota. And we'll start things off at the state legislature, where the Republican-controlled state Senate has made a proposal to the DFL-controlled House to try to get a budget bill put together. Unfortunately, there are a bunch of poison pills in this so-called offer from the Senate Republicans. We'll run down some of these, and you'll start to figure out why this proposal from the Republicans really has no chance of ever getting signed into law. Among the provisions in the Minnesota Senate proposal for their budget includes waiving COVID-19 equal opportunity penalties against businesses. Yes, because for some reason, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, I guess that means companies should no longer have to abide by the Equal Opportunity Employment Office and those provisions for some reason. That's among some of the requirements in the Republican bill. Also in the Republican bill includes introducing voter ID and provisional balloting. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. Other provisions in their bill include lifting the COVID masking requirements, ending the eviction moratorium. That just seems cruel that we would all of a sudden end the eviction moratorium while we're still in the middle of a pandemic. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes, too. They would also like to, the Republicans in the state Senate, delay the clean car rules that are being proposed by Governor Tim Walz, and eliminate mask requirements in local communities. So these are all of these poison pills that were basically put into the Republican-controlled Senate's global offer, as they call it, to the Minnesota House as they try to reach a budget deal. Now, as you can imagine, Democrats are not exactly going to be on board with several of these Republican ideas. Chief among them is Republicans trying to revive the idea of having voter ID. You might remember back during the 2012 election cycle where we actually had a constitutional amendment on the 2012 ballot asking Minnesotans if we should have a requirement for voter ID. Minnesotans, of course, voted that down by a pretty wide margin, by almost 10 percentage points. But Republicans want to bring this back. Now, why would they do that after this already lost a little less than 10 years ago by a pretty wide margin? Well, David Montgomery over at NPR put together a map that I think explains why Republicans are trying to revive this push for voter ID in Minnesota. So David broke down a map of Minnesota, and he broke down the number of counties that were listed as being solid GOP but voted against the voter ID bill back in 2012. So in other words, these are precincts from around the state that generally lean Republican, that mostly vote for Republican candidates, but back in 2012 voted against voter ID. And the map is very striking, especially when you look at Southwest Minnesota. I would say if you use pretty rough definition of what you would call maybe the southwestern quarter of Minnesota, I would say about half those precincts are listed as being solid GOP that voted against the voter ID bill back in 2012. So I think Republicans, in light of the big lie being proposed by Donald Trump saying that he actually won the election, and then looking at this data and seeing that there are a lot of these Republican precincts that voted against voter ID in 2012, Republicans might be sitting there and thinking, well, maybe in 2022 we could get some support for voter ID, especially from several of these very Republican precincts that voted against the voter ID bill back in 2012. So you can check that out over on David Montgomery's Twitter feed. It's a really fascinating map that takes a look at these very Republican precincts that voted against voter ID back in 2012. Now, conversely, he also has a map of solid Democratic precincts that voted for the voter ID. And those precincts were mostly first and second ring suburbs around Minneapolis and St. Paul. But nonetheless, there are way more Republican precincts that voted against the voter ID back in 2012 if you take a look at that map. Now, I want to go back to this other provision that Republicans are proposing in their bill to Minnesota House DFLers, and that has to do with ending the eviction moratorium, which is just nuts to me when you consider that there are so many people that are going to be facing an eventual fiscal cliff. At least at the federal level, the moratorium on evictions is set to expire on June 30th, and there are millions of people who are going to be in a lot of trouble when it comes to paying their rent and paying their mortgages, because keep in mind, with this moratorium on evictions, that doesn't mean that the rent you owe right now has been forgiven or the mortgage amount that you owe right now has been forgiven. That just means you can't be kicked out of your home. But once that moratorium is lifted, all of that rent and all of those mortgage payments you missed, they're all of a sudden going to come due. And as you can imagine, that is going to set up a massive fiscal cliff, not just in Minnesota, but around the entire country. And Minnesota Senate Republicans, they're basically saying, let's end that eviction moratorium even earlier, which would have disastrous consequences for thousands of Minnesotans. Now, fortunately, like I said, none of these provisions will probably make it into a final bill, but not exactly good faith negotiations, as you can see by Republicans with all of these poison pills in their so-called global offer. All right, let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be chatting with Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer. Stay with us.
Hello, Richard from Auto Technical. Imagine life without a car, just getting to daycare, then to work on the bus. Do you have a car or truck to donate? We have families waiting for a reconditioned vehicle from Auto Technical. Your gift will change their lives. Remember, we recondition the vehicle so you'll receive a much higher tax deduction. 612-919-5526. AutoTechnical.org.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our live call-in talk show airing every Saturday from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights you need to know to live and age well. Each week, we talk with guests who provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and self-care for caregivers, and help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 on AM 950 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
Food Freedom Radio is generously supported by Seward Co-op, now offering the safety of full-service contactless shopping at both the Franklin and Friendship stores. Seward Co-op has dedicated pickup times for first responders, seniors, and those with compromised immune systems. Visit seward.coop and learn more about delivery provided by Soddenberg's Floral and Gifts, in addition to curbside pickup. It's that safe and easy. That's seward.coop/to-go. seward.coop/to-go.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
The only place I take my Sienna for service is Rudy Luther Toyota. After you buy your Toyota from Rudy Luther, the relationship is just beginning. Rudy Luther offers incredible service specials for your Toyota. You can find the specials online at RudyLutherToyota.com. Get great deals on tires, batteries, alignment, air filters, oil changes, and even wiper blades. Plus, their service department will inspect your vehicle and make sure it's good to go. For service on your Toyota, the only place to go is Rudy Luther Toyota, 5 miles west of Minneapolis on 394.
Hey, this is Tom Hartman. Listen to me weekdays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Find more at am950radio.com.
These days, our home is the center of our world. This is Gregory Rich, founder of Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drink in the Style right here on AM 950. If we're all going to be spending a lot more time at home, doesn't it make sense to make your space the most attractive and most functional space it can be? At Habitation, my experienced, degreed interior design staff can help you select the perfect furnishings for your home and your lifestyle. Furniture is more than one size fits all, and there's more to making a room work than a couple of chairs and a sofa. Whether it's a modular, sectional, carefully selected to maximize your living room, or the perfect bed, dresser, and nightstand combination to create your dream bedroom, Habitation can help you achieve the space you've always wanted. So check us out online at habitationdesign.com or schedule an appointment at our Edina showroom. Habitation Furnishing and Design. Make your home exceptional.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon as we're joined by Patrick Coulican, our usual Tuesday guest of the Minnesota Reformer. Great resource for the latest in Minnesota politics over at MinnesotaReformer.com, as today we'll be talking about the final few weeks of the legislative session, how the gubernatorial race could be shaping up in 2022 as we have a potential new Republican candidate, and we'll be chatting about the new Minnesota Reformer podcast set to be released on Friday. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Good to be here, as always.
So, sounds like you guys had a pretty big get for your first ever podcast being released on Friday, Minnesota Reformer Radio. Governor Tim Walz is going to be the guest, and that's certainly a big get if you want to give a little sneak preview about what people can expect from that conversation.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to get to talk to the governor for about 35 or 40 minutes yesterday, and it was a pretty interesting and wide-ranging conversation, which we covered the pandemic and some of the equity issues that have been such a big part of the discussion the past year or so, as well as quite a bit about police and the future of policing in Minnesota. So people should wherever they get their podcasts should sign up for Reformer Radio. And the idea is we're going to try to go a little deep on an issue and kind of give that step back perspective in context to help people understand an issue better. On this particular episode, I think we're going deeper on Tim Walz, I guess.
And you guys are going to be releasing those maybe about every week or so, or at least a few times a month. And sounds like people can find those wherever they get their podcasts. So look forward to checking that out on Friday, and hopefully we'll have a chance to air some of those as well on AM 950. But I think it's a very cool idea you guys are doing that, and I love the idea of doing a deep dive on some of the issues that you sometimes don't get to do on the radio airwaves.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's gonna, that's what we try to do with our writing and reporting, and I think that's going to be reflected in our in the podcast, and it's going to be a mix of somebody like Governor Walz, but then also a little sneak peek. The second episode is about a African-American business owner and how he's tried to survive during the pandemic and also the civil unrest. He's a Northside business owner. So we try to, from the halls of power to the streets, we're trying to hit both.
Again, that podcast name, Reformer Radio. Find that wherever podcasts are found, and they already have the trailer release. So go ahead and make sure you subscribe to Reformer Radio. And like I said, hopefully we'll be able to bring that podcast to the AM 950 radio airwaves in the near future. Well, let's dive into this legislative session here, Patrick, as we are coming down to the wire right now. And obviously, Governor Tim Walz and members of the DFL and the state legislature want some action on police reform, but probably to no one's surprise in the Republican-controlled Senate, they're not going to be doing anything. In fact, they're not even holding any hearings, nonetheless. And even expanding on this a little bit more, Ricardo Lopez, I know, was writing about the police lobby and how it's changed over the years, because I even remember back in the day, Patrick, where we would often have police unions that would endorse both Republicans and Democrats. It was never an automatic, we're going to endorse a Democrat or automatically going to endorse a Republican. It's changed over the years where the police lobby has largely fallen along Republican lines, and I have to imagine it's kind of partially the reason why we're probably not going to see any police reform action in the state Senate.
Right. To your point, I think Governor Mark Dayton, former Governor Mark Dayton, the police endorsement for him was an extremely important endorsement. I wasn't here, but people may remember that his campaign was really thought to be not going anyplace. And that police endorsement was a big deal. And he maintained a close relationship with the police lobby right up until 2016, after the police killing of Philando Castile and former Governor Dayton said, which I think was, to me, seemed pretty self-evident and on a lot of people, that if Philando Castile had been white, the outcome would have been different. And this was considered just completely beyond the pale. Ricardo talked to a former legislator named, Republican legislator named Nick Zerwas. He said that really kind of switched things. It really created this close alignment between the police lobby and the Republican Party. And I think that continued with President Trump. And that law and order message, and then the events of 2020 just put an exclamation point on it. And then to your point about, you know, what's going to happen with any policing reform this year, in our interview with Governor Walz, he said he is really committed to it. He's especially wants to end what are called pretextual police stops. So that's when you stop a car because it has a taillight out or what have you, or maybe they have a deodorizer hanging from their rearview mirror. You make that stop really with the intention of trying to search the car because you have some suspicions that there's drugs or guns in the car. And we've seen how those stops can lead to tragedy. They also tend to really aggravate the people who are the recipients of those stops, as you might imagine, and they really they're not great for police community relations. Walz says he really wants to stop that practice, but it's going to take legislation to do it. And the Senate Republicans are very close to the police lobby, and so I just don't see it happening. And there's also gubernatorial politics in play here. Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka is probably going to run for governor, and no doubt getting the police lobby's endorsement would be a huge deal on the Republican side. So he's not going to do anything to aggravate them, which probably segues into our next topic.
Yeah, no, let's kind of stay along those lines, at least with Governor Tim Walz. Do we have any idea on when he's talking about winding down his emergency powers? I know he was talking a little bit about that. Could that possibly be with another budget proposal he could be sending along to the state legislature? If you can talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure we're probably going to get some sort of budget offer from the Walz administration, and maybe an indication of what he would be thinking in terms of winding down his emergency powers with the COVID pandemic.
So I think what they're going to do is later in the week, probably on Thursday, they're going to announce that they're kind of opening up more of the state and more activities will be allowed. As far as I don't think it's going to actually end his emergency powers, and there's some sort of technical legal reasons he needs to keep those in place so that he can keep doing the widespread testing and vaccination programs and getting money from the federal government. But they're going to offer a kind of olive branch to Republicans in the legislature about opening up the state. And I think that's going to come later this week. Republicans just now, as we're talking, have made their first kind of opening budget offer. It's a total non-starter. It's not really an offer at all. It's just, it's just a statement of principles, if you will. It includes stuff like voter ID, which is never going to happen. Licensing abortion clinics, never going to happen. Their education budget includes this really extensive voucher program, which you can read about in the Reformer tomorrow. That's never going to happen. So we're very, very far from any kind of really serious negotiations based on the Republican offer. I know the governor is probably going to release his own kind of top line numbers. So we'll see how things go. But I think we're pretty far out.
And this kind of segues to another topic where one of your regular contributors, Charlene Briner, was talking about how when people who maybe don't pay that close attention to the legislature all of a sudden realize that it's the middle of May or approaching the middle of May, and it looks like we're going to go into overtime with the state legislature or maybe having a special session or, worst case, a government shutdown, it's easy to sit there and think, well, do they really just spend the last 4 months sitting at the legislature and doing nothing whatsoever? But she does bring an interesting perspective talking about how at the state legislature, there are a lot of decent people trying to do the right thing for their constituents, but it's a complicated process, and especially when you involve the politics and the gaming over of trying to negotiate down, like kind of what the Republicans are doing with these voter ID bills and other things that have no chance of passing. It's a lot about positioning. So, I don't know, I just found that to be kind of an interesting commentary she had, how it's easy to sit there and be frustrated when you see that we're in May and it looks like the legislature really hasn't done anything, at least from the public's perception.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've talked about this before, and it's certainly in our mission at the Reformer, we're trying to get people to focus on the legislature because it has so much money and power, and it really would work better if more people were paying attention to it and involved in the process. But most people just don't pay attention to it, and Charlene also lands on an interesting point, saying, like, if you don't really like the legislature, we really have only ourselves to blame, because it just means that too many of us are not voting. But just as important, too many of us who, you know, maybe we vote, but we don't hold them accountable for their actions or lack of actions. So definitely tune in for the next 2 weeks. It should be interesting to watch how things develop, and if, I mean, they have a deadline, and this is why they do all their work at the end. It's because this is human nature. I mean, I'm somebody who works in the deadline business, so I'm familiar with it. You wait until the end, and it's just, especially when you're negotiating, everybody's using the clock, trying to use the clock to their advantage. So it seems like they're, if it seems like they're procrastinating and acting like your teenage kid with his college applications or something, it's sort of baked into the system.
All right, one final topic I want to go through you here, Patrick, and that has to do with positioning for the gubernatorial race. We usually talk about this every couple of weeks, and it looks like we might be having a new potential Republican candidate, although I don't think it's official quite yet, but State Senator Michelle Benson from Ham Lake looks like she is going to be entering the gubernatorial race. And we had a little conversation about this yesterday on our show, talking about how, well, she's not necessarily that well known in terms of name recognition. She does have a unique angle that maybe you could kind of position Ham Lake as part of the metro area and market yourself as a Republican member of the metro area. But it's an interesting campaign she could be launching. Obviously, the name recognition could certainly cause some issues for her, but Metro Area Republican could maybe have a little bit of an advantage when it comes to electoral politics.
Yeah, and I also think that as the only woman in the race, if that turns out to be the case, I think there'd be an advantage there. I think that she could appeal to her, to the women convention delegates. Mm-hmm. And then also just Republicans know that they have this huge gender gap. They lose women by such huge margins, and maybe she could help on that. And, she's thought of highly in some circles of the legislature as a serious policymaker. She chairs Health and Human Services budget. It's a huge, very complex budget. It's the second largest budget after education, and there's just a myriad number of programs, and there's a lot of interaction with the federal government. So, I mean, there's a seriousness about her that I think at this point you're not getting out of someone like former Senator Scott Jensen, who is running with some kind of different, interesting circles, I'll say,
yes,
to use a Minnesota term, and, you know, making kind of COVID trutherism the centerpiece of his campaign. I think that that perhaps Michelle Benson can be the, she's a sort of modern, mainstream woman Republican. Now, after Donald Trump, I don't know that that's what the Republican Party wants.
And I want to ask you about this, too, because at least when it comes to federal elections and especially at the presidential election, endorsements are a big deal, especially from members of Congress. And I just wonder how that plays out, at least at local state legislatures, because while Michelle Benson probably is a well-known name within the state capitol, probably the same with someone like a Scott Jensen, they're not all that well-known statewide from people who generally don't follow politics. So I'm always curious if, you know, you get endorsements from a bunch of members of the state legislature or a high-ranking member like, oh, I don't know, let's say Kurt Dowd, how much that means, because Benson and others will certainly have some trouble with name recognition, but do endorsements really mean that much, at least from members of the state legislature or, more importantly, leadership at the state level when it comes to these types of elections? Just want your take on that.
Well, the two parties have diverged a little bit on this. Democrats, or the DFL, no longer seem to nominate the candidate who wins their convention endorsement. I mean, you have to go back to Wendell Anderson to find a Democrat who won the endorsement and was nominated by the party. Tim Walz is the most recent example. He did not win the convention endorsement. Aaron Murphy did, but he won the primary. Republicans have maintained that discipline, however, in winning the convention is still the thing you got to do on the Republican side. And so it's a very much an insider game to do that. You're trying to rack up, it depends on the year, but I think it's like 1,700 delegates or something. And so you're just trying, and so you want to gather folks who have relationships with those insiders, the people who are always going to their county convention and so forth, and it's very often the same people who wind up at the state convention. If Kurt Dowd, who's currently the House Minority Leader, he's got relationships that go back a long time, you know, at least a decade with a lot of people, and he can kind of play kingmaker in a way. And I think that Tom Emmer is another one who would have that kind of influence. And maybe Pete Stauber up in the eighth. So those relationships are important, and those endorsements will matter.
Well, we'll have to see how that plays out over the next few months. That's Patrick Coulican, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, website minnesotareformer.com for the latest in Minnesota politics. And do make sure you check out their debut episode of Reformer Radio, wherever podcasts are found, as their first guest on that podcast will be none other than Governor Tim Walz. That's Reformer Radio, and possibly coming to the AM 950 airwaves sometime in the near future. Patrick, appreciate the time today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be here.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about the Democrats' infrastructure bill. It does a whole lot more than build just roads and bridges. In fact, there are a lot of benefits that are going to help seniors and disabled people around the country. We're going to be chatting with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare about some of these provisions in the infrastructure bill up next on AM 950.
Get up to $650 cash back on thousands of in-stock appliances from top brands during Warner's Stellian Stimulus Sale. Transform your kitchen with the style of GE Profile and get up to $2,000 back on qualifying suites. Relax with safe, free local delivery in Holloway by our trusted specialists. Plus, get 18 months 0% financing. There's never been a better time to upgrade your home than the Warner's Stellian Stimulus Sale. In store or at WarnerStellian.com.
The weather is finally warmed up, and while that's mostly good news, there are some downsides if you're someone like me who has seasonal allergies. And it's not just the outdoors that can trigger your allergies. Did you know that as many as 1 in 5 Americans suffer from allergies caused by particles frequently found in the air inside most homes? If you or anyone in your family suffers from allergies or asthma, or you just want to breathe cleaner, healthier air, Zero Res can help. Not only will an air duct cleaning from Zero Res help this allergy season, but you'll enjoy less dust, lower energy bills, and your home will stay cleaner longer. And because no one is more passionate about cleaning, Zero Res just replaced their entire duct cleaning fleet with brand new H2 HyperVac trucks that use state-of-the-art equipment to make your home even more breathable. You owe it to yourself and your home to get rid of those indoor allergy triggers and breathe healthy, happy, and clean with Zero Res. And if you mention AM 950 this month when you call, you'll get an additional $50 off your duct cleaning. But you need to mention AM 950. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMinnesota.com.
Hi, it's Tom. Solar power is more important than ever as a long-term investment for yourself and your community. And that's why I trust All Energy Solar to provide a cost-effective, environmentally friendly energy system. But several key incentives that make solar available will be sunsetting in 2021. So now is the time to get your solar project on the books. All Energy Solar can walk you through the process using their zero-contact virtual evaluation process. Financing options are available to those who qualify. So go green and start saving at allenergysolar.com.
KTNF AM 950, St. Louis Park, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Hey, your mother called, and she says she doesn't want flowers for Mother's Day. She wants a gift from Chocolat Celeste instead. Chocolat Celeste will surprise and delight. Created from premium chocolate from France and Germany, your mother will feel so special no matter if it's your own mom, someone else's, or your dog's. So don't just settle for inferior chocolates from your grocery store or drugstore. Get something truly special for mom. High-quality, award-winning artisan chocolates from locally owned Chocolat Celeste. Order online for local pickup or nationwide shipping at chocolatceleste.com.
Think your company's safe? Your staff is working from home, right? As I speak, cyber criminals are mounting attacks across the country. Remember, when we're weakest, cyber criminals attack. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld from Rimark. The Rimark team is guiding our clients through these difficult times. In fact, demand has been so high, we created an easy-to-follow guide. It's yours free. Download our 5 steps to securely work from home now at RimarkIT.com or call 651-328-8900 for a no-cost how-to discussion.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for clear skies overnight with a low around 38. Wednesday, partly cloudy with a high near 56. Thursday, partly cloudy with a high near 60. And Friday, sunny with a high around 61. And with Mother's Day coming up on Sunday, make sure you check out one of the AM 950 advertisers for a gift for mom. They have you covered in just about any category you can think of, and lots of our advertisers have curbside pickup and special deals on shipping. Find a full list of all of our advertisers at AM950radio.com. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, as we've probably heard from the Biden administration, their biggest new push is going to be on the infrastructure bill. As members of Congress are debating on what that bill will look like, are Republicans going to have any input, or is this going to be similar to the COVID relief bill where it's only Democrats passing it? But with the infrastructure bill likely to come to the floor at some point in the next few months, I thought it was important to talk about what actually is in Joe Biden's infrastructure bill, because there's a whole lot more to it than just roads and bridges. There's a lot of good stuff in there that could really benefit seniors and people who are disabled. So joining us to talk about that is Max Richman. He is the president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Website is ncpssm.org. He's also the chairman of the Leadership Council of Aging Organizations, LCAO, as we're going to be talking about what's in this infrastructure bill and how it impacts seniors. Max, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. So let's break down what's in this bill. One of the things that immediately caught my eye in the infrastructure bill is that there's $400 billion for expanding Medicaid beneficiaries' access to home and community-based care for seniors and also people who are disabled. Can you talk a little bit about what that $400 billion would mean and how that would impact seniors and some of our members of the disabled community? Because oftentimes, and I even know some friends of mine who are disabled that end up having to go to nursing homes, sometimes temporarily, it's an ugly situation, and adding more funds to helping seniors and disabled people stay at home or stay in community-based housing is a good thing.
Well, absolutely, and I'm sure those friends you referred to would prefer to stay at home.
Absolutely.
Rather than being in an institution. So this there's some very important elements to the infrastructure bill that are clearly designed to anticipate and address the needs of seniors and currently and into the future. We know this is an astounding figure. I think would be to most people, over 10,000 people turn 65 every day. So that cohort of people is growing dramatically. I saw a recent article in the Washington Post that said that the number of seniors is projected to grow by more than 40 million people, approximately doubling by the year 2050. So this is a population that is getting larger and will need assistance when it comes to health care and assistance, whether they stay at home or are in an institution. The bill, as you pointed out, adds a lot of money, $400 billion, to the Medicaid program, and it's designed to help people receive the care they need at home rather than an institution, which, as I pointed out at the outset, that's where most people want their that kind of care. And by the way, it's obviously these days with the pandemic, it's safer and it's less expensive. So we are very pleased that the president inserted this component into the infrastructure bill. A lot of people think, well, that's not infrastructure. We disagree with that. This is a very essential component of this infrastructure bill, and it has a lot of pieces to it that perhaps we can get into.
Yeah, there's a lot of funding in there that would help a lot of seniors and people who are from the disabled community. And you and I were kind of talking off air. This could be one of the only chances we have to actually get this type of housing expanded because, well, $400 billion is a lot of money, and it's tough to get that in a standalone bill. So if we get this in infrastructure, it would have such a positive impact for so many reasons, as you brought up, that I hope maybe we can even highlight this. Maybe as people who support this can highlight some of these benefits, because I'm afraid right now when I hear the infrastructure debate, we often hear Republicans say, well, it should only be for roads and bridges and this other money that's in this bill. It's all just a bunch of waste. But as you pointed out, $400 billion is a significant amount of money, and it's going to help a lot of people. So I hope that the messaging improves on this, because this is going to have an enormous impact on seniors.
Well, and it does so in a couple of very key ways. One of the problems with delivery of this care in the home is that there aren't enough people providing it. And one of those reasons is because the salaries for home care workers is pretty pathetic. The average home care worker is earning about $17,000 a year, not much above poverty level. And this is in large part due to the fact that in this country, those home care workers are paid limited amounts through the states through the Medicaid program. This legislation would funnel a huge increase into the Medicaid program to provide for home care, and it also would address the issue of having enough people to perform this service. One thing that caught my eye when I was looking through the background on this is right now, more than half of the home care workers currently on the job are also on some form of public assistance, such as food stamps, because the salaries are so low. President's infrastructure bill would expand the Medicaid. It's called Money Follows the Person program, where an individual can stay at home or go for an institution back to a home setting. And it does that by adding this $400 billion to the Medicaid program. These funds would be available for home and community-based services in states. It would boost the pay for home care workers. It would offer them something they don't have now, which is paid leave, health care for themselves, for caregiving workers, and other benefits. So, you know, I think it's going to address a number of aspects of the home care need. And home care is caregiving at home is a very rapidly growing industry. We're going to require in the next 6 or 7 years probably over 4 million additional home care workers to meet the needs that we see happening daily. So I'm hoping that by giving an incentive for home care workers to either stay or enter that profession, to provide funding for them to be paid and benefits to give them more of an incentive to stay in those jobs, that we'll be able to address this pretty serious deficiency that exists right now.
And those numbers you gave were just unbelievable for some of these workers, where they're making as little as $17,000 a year or $12 an hour, which is criminally underpaid when you have these workers that are caring for our most vulnerable citizens. And even that should just be reason enough for people to say that, hey, they should get a wage. But even if you're not necessarily on board with that, think about that from your own perspective. Let's say you're someone who, you know, has to end up in a nursing home later in life or needs to get home-based care. Do you really want to be cared by for someone that's making $12 an hour or $17,000 a year, that's barely scraping to get by? And that would be a very scary situation, at least for me personally, as I think about myself later in life. And I hope other folks do too, because if you're at that very vulnerable stage in life, you probably don't want someone who's making next to no money and maybe doesn't have the best training because of financial circumstances caring for you. You actually want someone who's well-trained and well-paid.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've met people who do this kind of work. It's really God's work. But there's only so much that we can expect from these providers of in-home care. And they need to be compensated fairly. I think the president's heart's in the right place, and the legislation addresses something that is really overdue. I'm looking forward to working on this with the administration, to lobbying as effectively as I can, the House and the Senate, to make sure this additional $400,000 for home and community-based care remains in the final package. It's a long way to go. Hopefully in the next month or two, we'll be able to get over the finish line.
So if you've had a chance to work with this bill closely, especially on some of those provisions, are you confident that at least all or part of this money will remain in a final bill? Because as we kind of know about the sausage making in Congress, oftentimes there's compromise, and we do have Democrats on the Hill that say, well, we should get some Republicans on board. And, well, if that happens, there's chances for cuts to be made to the infrastructure bill. So I just want to kind of gauge the temperature on the chances that at least all or part of this money could stay in a final bill that ends up on the House and Senate floor.
I'm pretty optimistic because, as you point out, this affects people living in red states and blue, as well as blue states. And I think when more people hear about the need for this kind of legislation, this kind of funding for home and community-based care, I think they'll have more of a possible success in getting it through the Congress. You know, whether it ends up being bipartisan or not, you know, I have no idea. You brought that out in your introduction. I think the president obviously would like it to be that bipartisan piece of legislation, but, you know, if that's not possible, we've seen that he's willing to go with only those in his own party if that's the only way to do it.
Speaking with Max Richman, he is the chairman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, also with the organization Leadership Council of Aging Organizations, LCAO, as we're talking about how the infrastructure bill does more than just build roads and bridges. It has a major impact on helping those that are from the disabled community and those that are senior citizens. And I want to move on and talk about some other aspects that are in this bill, and one that really caught my eye was that we have 15 million seniors that live in communities where public transportation basically is non-existent. And I know this from firsthand experience. My first radio job was at a small town in Iowa, and they were just launching a pilot program for busing for seniors. But prior to that, it was very tough to get around town. So I want to ask you this, Max, as you've had a chance to look at what's in this potential bill. How would it improve public transportation for seniors?
Well, it improves public transportation across the board, and would apply to seniors as well. You know, seniors probably rely, since they don't drive as often as younger people, they rely on public transportation to a greater degree. You know, whether it's bridges, roads, or any of the commonly looked at pieces of infrastructure, but I described it not long ago as we, you know, often think about our aging infrastructure, right? What the proposal that the president has put out there, I call it not just aging infrastructure, but the infrastructure of aging, and that's a really important distinction, and I think we ought to keep that in mind.
The infrastructure of aging. Yeah, I really like that term. That's a fitting way to put it, because we do have some aging infrastructure. And, well, if you have aging infrastructure, that doesn't help people who are aging as well.
Exactly. And that would bring in the question that you posed as how can people, older people, how can they get wherever they need to go? Having roads that are improved, bridges that are improved, helps them along with everybody else.
Moving on to another topic that I know we've been debating in Minnesota periodically over the past few years, and that has to do with rural broadband and just broadband in general and making sure people do have access to high-speed internet. Obviously, that need has been extra highlighted with the COVID-19 pandemic. But in this bill, are there any provisions that could improve broadband access for seniors?
Absolutely. It's across the board. It's not just bridges, roads. It is broadband. And I can tell you, since the pandemic hit, my wife and I have a little farm in rural Virginia. We've been out here since March 16th, gone back to D.C. only a few times in the last 13, 14 months. And we are sorely lacking in broadband, which is a problem. I know that firsthand when I tried to go through our Wi-Fi to be on a Zoom to testify before a congressional committee. It's very dicey, and I know I'm not alone. And during this period, it's been painfully obvious that there are communities such as the one I live in that really need improvements when it comes to broadband.
So what sorts of improvements would this do for broadband? Would this be federal funding to extend access to rural areas around the country? I'm just curious about how this would kind of work at the federal level.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I've heard it described as the effort that was made many years ago to bring electricity to rural areas, which was sorely needed back in the 20s and 30s. And now we're 100 years later, and we need assistance at the federal level to allow people to connect, whether it's seniors being able to use telemedicine, whether it's kids needing broadband to have access to their education. This is an opportunity of a lifetime, I think, when it comes to what we talked about before, home care, delivery of home care, or broadband. I think we're in a period that's going to make a huge difference if we're successful when we look back on it years from now.
And one final topic I want to go through with you here, Max, and this has to do more with affordable housing. It looks like in this bill we have a little over $200 billion that's being dedicated to affordable housing and specifically going towards the Section 202 program, which finances supportive housing for low-income seniors and provides some much-needed rent subsidies as well. So talk a little bit about what's in Section 202 and the need to get more funding into this program so people have access to affordable housing.
Section 202 has been a very successful program all over the country. It's helped people be able to afford their housing. And this, as you pointed out, this infrastructure bill would pump more money into that. I think the president is keenly aware that that the infrastructure now has to help and is needed to be improved to help all of the communities that you just talked about, whether it's rural, people that need help with their housing, those people that have benefited from Section 202 housing will be able to continue to benefit from it, and it will allow more people to apply and get approved for Section 202 housing.
We've been speaking with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. That website is ncpssm.org. Basically, just the initials of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Again, ncpssm.org. Max is also with the LCAO. That's the Leadership Council of Aging Organizations. Encourage you to follow both of those groups to find out what's in this infrastructure bill because, again, like we brought up at the start of the interview, it's easy to get lost in a gigantic infrastructure bill and just focus on the roads and bridges aspect when there's lots of other good provisions in that infrastructure bill. So, Max, do appreciate you taking the time to walk through some of these different provisions in the infrastructure bill and telling us what's in it and explaining more information. Thanks so much for the time today.
Well, thank you. And I think the more people find out about this, they'll understand that infrastructure isn't just about building better bridges and better roads, but it's also about investing in our seniors' health, well-being, and dignity. And I think hopefully members of Congress will come to the realization that that's a return on the investment that we should all get behind.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. Hey, Max, thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that's just about going to do it for today. Matt McNeil should return later this week. Stay tuned. Up next, we got Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake.